This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
At our top stories this hour, the Iranian president says Tehran seeks to develop relations with countries like Cuba that stand against, quote, excessive demands of the global arrogance. The secretary general of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says the results of the country's parliamentary elections show people support the resistance. Also, the UN secretary general warns about years of mass hunger and famine as the war in Ukraine worsens the global food crisis. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. The Iranian president describes Iran-Cuba relations as a strategic, saying there are various grounds for the all-out expansion of the two countries' ties. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks in a meeting with Cuba's deputy prime minister, Ricardo Cabrises. Raisi said Tehran is bent on developing relations with independent countries like Cuba that stand against cold excessive demands of the global arrogance. The Iranian president described Tehran-Havana relations as positive and constructive. He added that the two countries can boost cooperation in such areas as trade, economy, agriculture, and healthcare. For his part, Cabrissa said the strategic relations between the two sites can be further expanded through short and long-term plans. Iran and Cuba have for years been under U.S. sanctions. The United Nations envoy on the impacts of sanctions has wrapped up her 10-day visit to Iran. Her trip was aimed at assessing the human rights violations caused by the United States sanctions on Iran. Our correspondent, Yusuf Jaludi, reports.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran, Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
The UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S. to shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are legal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the U.N. Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement has hailed the results of the country's parliamentary elections as a great victory for the resistance front. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah says the gains of Hezbollah and its allies in the elections show the people support the resistance and want it to keep its weapons. He also praised the Lebanese people for their massive participation in the electoral process despite all the economic, social, and political upheavals in the country. Nasrallah said the vote or voters' enthusiasm and turnout showed they didn't care about 3 years of media campaign to boycott the vote. Hezbollah and its allies have won 62 seats in the 128-member assembly. 13 seats have also gone to independent candidates who have yet to choose a bloc. The Political Bureau Chief of the Palestinian Resistance Movement, Hamas, has warned that any attempt by Israel to assassinate resistance leaders would lead to an all-out conflict in the region. Ismail Haniyeh issued the warning in letters sent to the leaders of many regional countries. According to his media advisor, Haniyeh urged the countries to warn the Israeli regime and its leaders against returning to its assassination policy. He stressed that the regime would pay an unexpected price if it goes ahead with its plan. That after Israeli media recently cited senior military sources as saying that the assassination of top Hamas officials is still an option. The report said that Hamas leader in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Deif, the commander of the group's military wing, Qassam Brigades, are the obvious targets. Earlier, our Gaza correspondent Ashraf Shannon joined us with a take on Israeli threats to assassinate senior Hamas officials. Let's take a listen.
Some analysts believe that the reason for such threats is that the so-called coalition government within the Israeli regime is fragile, and possibly the Israeli prime minister trying to garner support from other members of his government and the Israeli Knesset by making threats against Palestinian resistance factions, especially that we saw over the last few weeks an increase in resistance operations within the Israeli regime. The Israeli regime trying to scapegoat the resistance factions by blaming them for carrying such attacks. They mainly blame Hamas's leader in Gaza, Yahya al-Sinwar, who during the last days of the holy month of Ramadan, called on all Palestinians within occupied historical land of Palestine to use all forms of resistance against the Israeli forces, whether it's knives or axes or anything that they have available against Israeli soldiers and police.
Moving on, the UN Secretary General has warned about years of mass hunger and famine if no steps are taken to contain a global food crisis worsened by the war in Ukraine.
Russia must permit the safe and secure export of grain stored in Ukrainian ports. Alternative transportation routes can be explored, even if we know that by itself they will not be enough to solve the problem. And Russian food and fertilizers must have unrestricted access to world markets without indirect impediments. I have been in intense contact on this issue at the senior leadership level with the Russian Federation, Ukraine, Turkey, the United States, the European Union, and several other key countries. I am hopeful, but there is still a long way to go. The complex security, economic, and financial implications require goodwill on all sides for a package deal to be reached.
Antonio Guterres was addressing a food security meeting at the UN. He said the war in Ukraine is compounding global food insecurity amid warming temperatures and the coronavirus pandemic. The UN chief said the number of severely food insecure people has doubled from 135 million to 276 million in just 2 years. Guterres said the war in Ukraine threatens to tip tens of millions of people over the edge into food insecurity. The war and economic sanctions on Russia have increased global prices for food and fuel, especially in developing countries. Russia and Ukraine account for nearly a third of global wheat supplies. Russia says nearly 700 more Ukrainian fighters have surrendered in the Azovstal Steelworks, their last holdout in the city of Mariupol. That brings to 960 the number of forces in the plant who have put down their weapons after being trapped there for over 2 months. However, Moscow says some 1,000 Ukrainian troops, including top commanders, are still fighting in Mariupol. The city is the biggest Russia has so far captured in the war that began on February the 24th. Tensions continue to run high between Russia and the West over Ukraine. Russia has expelled dozens of European diplomats in a tit-for-tat move. We further discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Moscow expels dozens of diplomats from France, Spain, and Italy, retaliation for a similar decision taken by the trio against Russia over its war in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry says 34 French diplomatic staffs have been declared persona non grata and have 2 weeks to leave the country. The ministry has also expelled 27 Spanish diplomats while announcing plans to 24 Italian staffers. The Italian Prime Minister has condemned the decision as a hostile act. Mario Draghi says diplomatic channels must not be interrupted. Last month, France, Spain, and Italy announced the expulsion of scores of Russian diplomats as part of a joint European action over the offensive in Ukraine. Russia has taken tit-for-tat measures against several Western countries since the launch of the war, which Moscow says is aimed at denazifying Ukraine. Our correspondent Jerome Hughes joins us from Brussels with the latest. We also have Vladimir Goldstein, who's an associate professor of Slavic studies, who joins us from Brown University, who joins us from Rhode Island. Welcome to you both. Jerome, over to you. Obviously, we are having these measures in this particular piece of news for diplomatic, I guess, dismissals. But I guess the bigger picture is more stark and more horrific in terms of the impact of this conflict as it is dragging on. What do you have for us in the latest developments?
That's right, Kaveh. Well, you know, anti-war groups have already been reacting to this, and they're very concerned that it's another sign of a move away from diplomacy. As you mentioned, the breakdown, 34 staff being sent home from Russia, French diplomats, 27 Spanish, 24 Italian. And don't forget, it's on the foot as well, off the back of 45 Polish embassy staff were sent away from Russia last month, and 40 German diplomats as well.
Jerome Hughes, you've been following this and reporting on this, at least from the European side. Is there a particular, vantage point that some of these parliamentarians have as to a timeline that this conflict is going to go through? I mean, because, you know, again, we're looking at some shocking factors that are
impacting the economy in Europe. You know, from wheat to obviously the energy prices, and these are not things that can be sustainable in the longer term when solutions have not really, again, been provided. I mean, at this point, we're looking at, for example, the U.S. And European oil companies, I guess, to resume their operations in Venezuela. But by the time these things really come into fruition, I mean, yes, oil maybe, but not gas. It's not easily replaced.
Well, Cave, what they're saying is, I mean, at the moment, they're trying to bring down inflation by putting up interest rates, which means that you could have a situation next year where a countless number of people in the EU lose their homes, people with home loans, mortgages. So, you know, we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg at the moment in terms of the cost of living. But what, if you listen to what some of the EU lawmakers are saying in the European Parliament, they're accusing the European Commission of really taking advantage of this crisis, that basically they're not interested in diplomacy until they get their agenda across the line. So it actually is not about citizens. It's about creating this EU army. It's about, you know, restructuring the whole EU so that it could be like a federal state, similar to what we have in the United States, with, you know, Brussels at the center of it all, controlling the thing. And that's not a conspiracy theory. That's what we seem to be moving towards now. And actually, you know, because of this conflict in Ukraine, it seems that the European Commission can come up with any sort of proposals it wants and any amount of money. And this, in addition to what I mentioned earlier, the EU, Ursula von der Leyen announced today, announced 200 billion euro, not 200 euro, 300 billion euro, this is separate to the defense side of things, 300 billion euro to support EU countries to move away from Russian energy. And this has been agreed by the EU member states. It will be signed off on the just under 2 weeks' time, on the 30th and the 31st of this month, here in Brussels. So it's a move towards getting more power for the European Commission, getting more power for the EU, and all the while, really ordinary citizens are really struggling, but they will struggle much more, it would appear.
Okay, Vladimir Goldstein, in less than a minute, please, since we're almost out of time, how do you see this conflict moving forward, long-term, or something that may evolve into some kind of political solution in the next month, maybe?
Yeah, well, so far we witnessed this kind of crisis of diplomacy because West and NATO is not willing to negotiate. So I think, unfortunately, a lot depends on the, you know, on the battlefield. I suspect if Russia sort of moves ahead, sooner or later, people in Ukraine will be the first one to rebel and say, let's, you know, make some kind of a peace deal, because that's another crisis of diplomacy. There is no interest in negotiation between these two countries. The United States conducting its proxy war, utilizing everything at its feet. But I think once Russia shows some kind of successes, if not, then the whole thing will continue. Okay. But I hope that Russia have enough strength and stamina and a kind of a resolution to keep on pushing until the West and NATO sit down and negotiate and restore diplomacy.
Thank you so much for that. Vladimir Goldstein, Associate Professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University from Rhode Island. Jerome Hughes, thank you so much. Correspondent there from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this news review.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profits on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Islam's victory over joint Arab-Israelite army. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Shalom, everybody, and today, the 17th of Shawwal is the anniversary of a very important event in the history of Islam and humanity that teaches us that the plots of satanic elements, whether at present or in the future, will continue to fail, since it is God Almighty who has guaranteed the triumph of the righteous, no matter what great armies, strategic alliances, and sophisticated weapons the wayward could muster. It is the day the crucial Battle of Khandaq, or Ditch, also known as Battle of Ahzab, or Confederates, since the Arabs and Israelites had ganged up together against Islam, ended on a victorious note for Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Please stay with us for a special feature. Allah sent back the faithless in the rage, without their attaining any advantage. and Allah spared the faithful of fighting, and Allah is all strong, almighty. This is how the Almighty Creator sums up in Ayah 25 of Surah Ahzab the defeat and retreat of a formidable 10,000-strong joint Arab-Israelite army that had marched upon Medina to kill the Prophet with the help of the hypocrites amongst the Muslims and to obliterate Islam. Following the failure of the first ever armed encounter imposed upon the Prophet by the infidels of Mecca at Badr in 2 AH, the Arabs and the Israelites had been fuming with rage and devising plans to uproot Islam. Abu Sufyan, the archenemy of Islam, held talks with the Arabicized Jew Ka'b al-Ashraf, and the two, after showing reciprocal respect for each other's dubious creeds, pledged to muster a formidable joint force against the seal of messengers. God Almighty has pointed to this conspiracy in Ayah 53 of Surah Nisa. Have you not regarded those who were given a share of the book, believing in the idol and the evil spirit, and saying of the pagans, these are better guided on the way than those who have faith in Islam? With the mysterious death of Ka'b, the joint plot did not materialize, and the Umayyad infidel Abu Sufyan, in his thirst for avenging the defeat at Badr, marched upon Medina in 4 AH, but failed to achieve his goal. Thanks to the swordsmanship of Imam Ali, peace upon him, that saved the Prophet and Islam in the Battle of Uhud. The next year, in 5 AH, Abu Sufyan assembled warriors from as many Arab tribes as he could, and in league with the Israelite tribes of Banu Nadir and Banu Quraizah, the latter having breached their pledge of neutrality to the Prophet, descended upon Medina with a force of 10,000 that boasted in the ranks the warlord Amr ibn Abduwad, who was a veritable giant known for his brute strength. Having been informed of the Arab-Israelite plot against Islam, the Prophet prepared the defenses of Medina, whose natural fortifications were rocky heights and thick palm groves, and, on the suggestion of his Iranian companion, Salman Farsi, dug a deep trench on the strip of the city that was vulnerable to enemy attack. While digging the ditch that involved the removing of huge boulders, which emitted sparks when struck by pickaxes, the Prophet gave tidings of the liberation of Syria, Iran, and Yemen by the Muslims in the future, at which the hypocrites amongst his companions expressed disbelief and hoped that this battle would result in the end of Islam. When the Confederate army arrived, it found its entry blocked by the newly dug ditch. For 15 days, the joint Arab-Israelite forces maneuvered, often shooting arrows at the Muslim defenders on the other side, but couldn't find a way to enter the city. With patience stretched thin, on the 17th of Shawwal, Amr ibn Abduwad, along with two other horsemen, found the narrowest point of the ditch and managed to spare their horses for a giant leap to the other side. Amr hurled a spear at the Prophet's tent and challenged the Muslims to single combat, at which most of the newly converted Muslims quaked with fear. While the hypocrites amongst them devise plans to seize the prophet and hand him over to the enemy. The prophet of peace, in order to impart an immortal lesson to mankind that anyone who dares to desecrate the sanctity of the messenger of God and whatever he possesses is worse than an animal, said, "Who will confront this dog?" Thrice he repeated these words, and on all three occasions no one got up except his dear cousin, son-in-law, and divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. Some of the Muslims, who were actually the fifth column, instead of responding to the Prophet's call, started to praise the strength and physical power of Amr ibn Abdu'l-Wad in a bid to demoralize the ranks of the faithful, similar to what the self-styled Muslims in the service of the US and the West do today by extolling the military might of the illegal Zionist entity and the benefits for the Arabs to ally with the Israelis against Islamic Iran. The Prophet gave permission to the Imam to face the challenge of the Arab-Israelite warlord, saying, "The embodiment of faith is all set to fight the embodiment of infidelity. The rest is history, as recorded in all books of hadith and history by both Sunni and Shia Muslim authorities." Imam Ali, peace upon him, after inviting Amr to Islam and telling him to live in peace instead of risking his life, conditions which the arrogantly ignorant pagans spurned, engaged in combat and won the fray. With a flashing stroke of his famous twin-bladed sword, Zulfaqar, Imam Ali, peace upon him, dispatched Amr to the netherworld, but not before allowing him to renew the life and death combat, because the cowardly representative of the Arab-Israelite force, when hurled to the ground, had dared to spit at him. That was among the reasons the Prophet had hailed his cousin's selfless feat, which was solely for the sake of God and without personal emotions involved in the combat, as the stroke of Ali on the day of Khandaq is superior to the worship of the Thaqalayn, mankind and jinn combined. At this spectacle, the Arab-Israelite force, which was viewing the combat from the other side of the ditch, lost heart. And as God Almighty sent strong gales to disrupt their encampment, the enemies fled. Thus, Imam Ali saved the Prophet of Islam and Islam from yet another nefarious plot, and of course, spared the rest of the Muslims, the weak of faith and the hypocrites combined, from a fight for which they had no stomach. The lessons of the Battle of Khandaq are all too obvious for us and teach us that the victory of Islam and Muslims is only possible through firm adherence to the path of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The true path of the Prophet means allegiance to Imam Ali, peace upon him, and the rest of the blessed Ahlul Bayt in these crucial times when global arrogance, led by the great Satan, the United States, has in its ranks an alliance of the devilish Zionist and the reactionary Arab regimes for splitting the unity of the Islamic Ummah through cowardly crimes against Muslims and the rest of humanity. In commemoration of this glorious triumph of Islam over the joint Arab-Israelite force, mosques were built near the site of the ditch in Medina, such as the Fat or Victory Mosque, the Mosque of Imam Ali, peace upon him, the Mosque of the Prophet's daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, and the Mosque of Salman Farsi, the Prophet's Iranian companion, on whose suggestion the ditch was dug at the vulnerable point of Medina to prevent the enemy from entering the city. Over the past millennium and four centuries, pilgrims to the land of revelation and local believers used to offer prayers at these mosques. Unfortunately, these mosques have now been destroyed by the heretical Wahhabi cult, which, despite its claim to be Muslim, follows Abu Sufyan, the infidel Arabs, and the Israelites, as is evident by the open dalliance of Bahrain, the UAE, Egypt, Jordan, and Morocco with the illegal Zionist entity called Israel, along with the secret relations between Tel Aviv and the Riyaz regime. We pray to God Almighty for the reappearance of the Prophet's 12th and last infallible heir, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, and the establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice in order to end tyranny and root all these heretical cults, such as the Wahhabis and Takfiris, which have tarnished the image of Islam and Muslims.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Shia Muslims in Nigeria. Mahdi can now walk and perform many chores like fetching water for ablution to perform his five daily prayers. These were near impossible after the horror of the December 2015 Zaria massacre, where hundreds were murdered in cold blood. Hundreds like Mahdi received life-threatening injuries in the three-day carnage. Walking for Mahdi was a torturous experience. Almost 3 years after the unbelievable horror, Mahdi still sits to vividly recall the atrocity. He was one of those shot and burnt alive by soldiers of the Nigerian army at Sheikh Zazaki's house in Gelesu, in the northern Nigerian city of Zaria, on December 13, 2015. Mahdi said he stayed without food for 72 hours and only survived because of the generosity of a good Samaritan who hid him away from the predators. During the carnage, Aisha was trapped in an upstairs building as intense shooting by the soldiers in Gelesu raged. Aisha said she survived by the grace of God. She had spent over 2 years treating bullet wounds on her leg. I apologize for making her recall the bitter experience.
An armed soldier will now go direct and face a private part of a lady and shoot, where grenades will be thrown to women to go and scatter their bodies. It happened. So it's a brutality that a heart will never imagine, and I will never like to see it again. The eye that saw it will never like to repeat it. It's very, very sudden.
It is totally condemnable. It is alien to our law, and it cannot be accepted in any civilized society. More so that up till now, none of the murderers has been brought to book. Contrary to the recommendation of the Garba Judicial Commission for Inquiry and the white paper issued by the Kaduna State Government.
That on Saturday.
So Malama Amina Mustafa lost 3 children in the Zaria massacre.
So let me go out and see.
But above all, she lost her husband, who she said was a friend, a reliable confidant, and a responsible and loving spouse. Malama said she misses her husband every day. Back in 2017, during the International Quds Day rally in Kaduna, her surviving son, Hussein, was shot in the back by the Nigerian police. She said Hussein lost a lot of blood at the scene and eventually became paralyzed from the waist down. Hussein has since dropped out of school because none of the available institutions have infrastructural provisions for the fiscally challenged. She says caring for Hussein is a difficult task. Every day, Malama says she wonders at the viciousness of the Zaria massacre, especially the seeming absence of humanity in the perpetrators. Victims of the Zaria massacre live in many households in many cities in northern Nigeria. We visited many homes in Zaria and Kaduna. We moved from one house to the other, knocking on doors in the hope of listening to their accounts of what many described as the reprehensible crimes committed against their spouses, relatives, and friends. This is the family of Ibrahim Ahmed Badiko, who was killed in the Zaria massacre. He left 12 children and 3 wives. One of the wives was pregnant when he died. Now the children are 13 without a breadwinner. The Shuhada Foundation was conceived and established by the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zazaki, in January 1992. It is now headed by Sheikh Abdulhamid Bello, who says the main objective for setting up the foundation is to cater to the needs of the families of the martyrs who lost their lives during the struggle to establish the cause of justice.
And from time to time, the climb down, you know, is increasing from time to time. So, but the worst one is what happened in this 2015, which we are registering almost 1,000 shuhada as a result of the climb down by this Buhari administration.
Most organizations depend on assistance from donors. However, Sheikh Abdelhamid says the Shuada Foundation has different ways of raising funds for taking care of the orphans and families of the martyrs.
We have what we call the Shuhada Dues. We have it every translated by 5 naira. Every member of the movement will give a monthly 5 naira as a due. So, but now it has come to 100 naira per month.
The Islamic movement holds the annual Shuhada Day in order to remember the contribution of the martyrs, to assess performance, and to find ways of restructuring the organization for better performance. Most of these orphans are children of the hundreds of members of the Islamic movement killed in the December 2015 Zaria massacre. The Shuhada Foundation says the task of catering for their needs has become even more challenging.
Before 2015, we have less than 300 children of the Shuhada that we take care of. But now we have over 2,000. You see, not even doubling, not even tripling. So, and from these children that they have increased in number, also their own demand is more than before. Because most of those 300 at that time, we have, in terms of education, for instance, most of them are in primary or secondary school. We have less than 10 that we are in the higher institutions. But now, we have more than 100 who are in the higher institutions.
Assalamu alaikum. We arrived at the house of late Abdullahi Abbas in Zaria to meet the family he left behind. Abdullahi Abbas was killed along with his 3 sons in Gelesu, the residence of Sheikh Zazaki. His senior wife expressed a lot of gratitude for the work of the Shuhada Foundation. She expressed her grief at the loss of her husband and sons, but said the final judgment will be done by Almighty God. The accounts by victims of the mass murders in Zaria are varied. They also vary in their horror and intensity. But all the accounts are united by one common feature. They were heinous crimes committed against members of a minority religious group that were unarmed. Experts have continued to insist that the 2015 bloodbath in Zaria amounts to genocide.
Once you, in a reckless manner, unleash such advanced mayhem on a member of an ethnic group or a religious body without any provocation, without any basis whatsoever, and more so, if they are unarmed, it's akin to genocide, which is a crime against humanity. And it's worse where the government refuses to bring the murderers to book.
Malama Zainab Sanusi still walks with a limp. She is also in perpetual pain because of bullets buried in various parts of her body. Malama Zainab narrated her harrowing experience in the hands of the soldiers who attacked the residence of Sheikh Zazaki in December 2015. Perhaps what was more despicable and cold-hearted, according to Malama Zainab, was when one of the soldiers threw a bullet at her as a souvenir. Counsel for Sheikh Zazaki and the Islamic movement in Nigeria, who is also a human rights activist, says beyond trying to get justice for the criminality of the massacre, the surviving victims still have another avenue towards getting justice.
I've suggested to the Shia community to put together all the numbers of all the victims, identify them one by one, because the laws allow them and I'm talking of the relations of the victims of the dead, to ask for compensation. But what I'm talking about will be the civil action against the government, the federal government, whose army killed unarmed innocent civilians.
For about 3 years, Sheikh Zazaki has remained in custody despite the ruling of a federal high court in Abuja, the Nigerian capital. The court ruled that Sheikh Zazaki's fundamental human rights have been violated. It asked the Nigerian government to set him free within 45 days, to pay him compensation, and to build a house for him following the destruction of his house by the Kaduna State government and soldiers of the Nigerian army. The Nigerian government has not obeyed the ruling of the court. It has also turned a deaf ear to all protests and pleas for the release of the Islamic cleric to go for medical treatment. Sheikh Zazaki lost an eye during the attack and is losing the other one. In a twist, the Kaduna State government has arraigned Sheikh Zazaki on a Kaduna High Court. Sheikh Zazaki is charged with unlawful assembly, criminal conspiracy, and culpable homicide punishable by death. Members of the Islamic movement have rejected these charges. Many of the victims of the Zaria massacre have lost their jobs. Some, like Aisha Yakub, have been forced to drop out of school, while others have been divorced from their spouses because of almost 3 years of separation due to detention prison. These serious issues have raised questions about human rights in Nigeria.
It's not rocket science to respect the rights of people. These are not illiterates or dropouts. These are well-educated people. And you need to respect their feelings, their views, and engage them in serious discussion. You can't crush them.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria strongly believes that an international conspiracy was responsible for the 2015 Zaria attack and the subsequent persecution of the Shia community that has continued up to now.
If you remember, the Saudi crown prince was in Saudi Arabia some months back, and he granted interview to the Time magazine. There, he listed his achievement, 3 years achievement. And there he said, crushing the Shia's influence in Nigeria. He mentioned Nigeria specifically. So it's not a mistake for anybody to say it was planned by Israel and America and sponsored by Saudi Arabia, implemented by a mass murderer.
Whatever the reasons behind the 2015 Zaria attack, some experts believe that the global enemies of Islam must be smiling with satisfaction at the outcome of the events regarding the Islamic movement in Nigeria. These attacks and crackdown, experts explained, are not good for the global unity of Islam.
Unfortunately, some leaders in the Muslim world are dancing to the tunes of their enemies, you know, by deepening the crisis and stoking, you know, this conflict that continues to fractionalize as well as divide, you know, Muslims of different faith.
There are many pending issues regarding the December 2015 massacre in Zaria. For example, who is going to answer for the 347 men, women, and children killed and buried in a mass grave on the outskirts of Kaduna?
As for those who did this shameful act, it's for them to be brought to book and be punished according to the law. Alhamdulillah, we have a case in the International Court of Justice, that is the ICC. We want the incoming government to give to hand them over to ICC whenever they need arises. And certainly, the Islamic movement will not hesitate to take them to court again within the country.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria also alleges that there are still dozens of girls abducted by the Nigerian military and hundreds of others who are still unaccounted for. Darul Rahama, during the 2015 massacre, was among the several properties of the Islamic movement that was desecrated and destroyed by the Kaduna State government. Members still visit the cemetery to offer prayers to their fallen members.
Our situation is worse than the one found in Israel. There is no human being or no group, that was oppressed or is being oppressed, as I'm talking to you, like the Shiite community.
We made several trips to the offices of the Attorney General and the Nigerian Minister of Justice and wrote several letters in order to get the response of the Nigerian government regarding the issue of the Shia Muslims, especially the case of Sheikh Zazaki. But the minister did not respond to our request for an interview. The Nigerian military and the Kaduna State government were also unwilling to grant interviews on the matter. Meanwhile, protests both at home and abroad have continued as the Nigerian Shia community demands for justice from a democratic government that has sworn to be fair to all Nigerians.
In the limelight. Brussels has vowed to respond with all measures at its disposal as Britain's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss sets out plan to make changes and rewrite the Northern Ireland Protocol. We now present you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart, Jennifer Rankin and Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled, EU Raises Spectre of Trade War if UK Rewrites Northern Ireland Protocol. The European Commission has raised the spectre of an economically damaging trade war with the United Kingdom, pledging to respond with all measures at its disposal if Foreign Secretary Liz Truss presses ahead with a plan to rewrite the Northern Ireland Protocol. The Foreign Secretary set out plans on Tuesday, 17th of May, to table a bill that would make changes to the protocol, including waiving all checks on goods flowing from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, where they are not destined for the Republic of Ireland. She said the UK government still hoped to agree the changes it believes are necessary, calling these comprehensive and reasonable, adding, "Our preference is to reach a negotiated outcome with the European Union. We have worked tirelessly to that end and will continue to do so." But she claimed the protocol in its current form jeopardised the stability of the Good Friday Agreement, which she said was under strain, and the government would act unilaterally if necessary. Liz Truss said, "To respond to the very grave and serious situation in Northern Ireland, we are clear that there is a necessity to act to ensure the institutions can be restored as soon as possible." Part of the government's motivation is to placate the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, which is refusing to enter a power-sharing government with Sinn Féin at Stormont unless the protocol is altered. The Democratic Unionist Party's Westminster leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, said Liz Truss's statement was welcome, if overdue step, that is, a significant move towards addressing the problems created by the Northern Ireland Protocol and getting power sharing based upon a cross-community consensus up and running again. Geoffrey Donaldson said his party would like to see progress on the legislation in days and weeks and not months. Liz Truss called for the EU's top official in charge of relations with the United Kingdom, Mara Šefčovič, to be given a rewritten negotiating mandate that would allow the protocol to be revised. However, Mara Šefčovič responded to Liz Truss's statement by issuing a veiled warning that the United Kingdom could lose its free trade arrangements with the European Union if it went ahead. Šefčovič, a European Commission vice president who has been leading talks on changes to the protocol, said Liz Truss's proposals raise significant concerns, adding unilateral actions contradicting an international agreement are not acceptable. He said in a statement, should the United Kingdom decide to move ahead with a bill disapplying constitutive elements of the protocol as announced today by the UK government, the European Union will need to respond with all measures at its disposal. According to Catherine Barnes,